directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Candace.
And my name is Yasmin.
And we'll be your hosts for today. On today's show, we have a pre-recorded interview with Josh Paven from the Prisoner Correspondence Project about the Correctional Services Canada's new policy regarding the incarceration of trans prisoners in federal prisons. We also have an interview that we are rebroadcasting from Prison Radio at CFRC in Kingston about resistance to pay cuts in prison. As most of you listening may know, February is Black History Month, and here on the Prison Radio Show, we feel it's important that we call attention to and recognize the reality that Black people are deliberately and disproportionately targeted by every aspect of the prison industrial system in both the United States and Canada, including racial profiling, police brutality, rates of incarceration, abuse and unjust treatment inside prisons, racist treatment in the court systems, and what is often referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline. And that this, the importance of talking about it, absolutely must not and cannot be limited to Black History Month. Next on the show, we are going to bring you some news.
So I wanted to remind our viewers that tonight there is a screening of the movie Free CC, and so in honoring Black History Month on Prison Radio Show and speaking to the issues that highlight the link between race and incarceration, I want to remind our listeners of the interview that Prison Radio Show conducted on our last show with the organizer of Masimari, which is the Afro-LGBTQ Brillman Art Festival that has been taking place this month here in Montreal. The interview with Laurent Lafontaine was really great and provided a lot of information about the festival, and he also spoke about the important screening of the film Free CC that is tonight. So I wanted to encourage our listeners to go out tonight and attend the screening. It's taking place at Never Apart, which is 7049 Saint-Urbain, and it'll be followed by a panel discussion with two Black trans women from Montreal. Entitled How Do We Navigate the World as Black Trans Women? And Free CC will be preceded by another short fiction feature about trans women directed by Concordia student Giovanni Almos. And just to remind our viewers, the movie Free CC is about Cece McDonald, who was attacked and was fighting for her own life. After a coercive interrogation, CC was incarcerated in a men's prison in Minnesota, and an international campaign to free CC garnered significant support from media and activists, including actress and executive producer of the film Laverne Cox. Laverne uses her platform to explore the roles of race, class, and gender played by CC's case. And in the film, CC emerges not only as a survivor, but as a leader. And the documentarian Jack Garris pushes past everyday narratives of victimhood that surround the lives of trans people to foreground the way that CC and other trans people are leading a growing movement to critically interrogate and disassemble the prison industrial complex. So in other news that links race, crime, and justice in Canada, I wanted to touch on a report put out by the John Howard Society on October 19th of 2017. In the report, it shows a lot of data that Indigenous and Black people are the subjects of unfair treatment through the criminal justice system, from contact with police to sentencing and parole. And that evidence is well summarized in a recent book that the report brings up in a chapter on inequalities in the Canadian justice system. The article by Akwasi Owusu-Bempa and Scott Wortley, both at the University of Toronto, appeared in the Oxford Handbook on Ethnicity, Crime, and Immigration. The article brings together data from many sources showing the extent to which Canada's criminal justice system systematically disadvantages people based on their background and appearance, and even though Canada does not do a good job of collecting or analyzing data based on background or ethnicity. And just to give you some stats, so victims of crime, so Aboriginal and Black people are more likely to be victims of crime. The Aboriginal murder rate in Canada is 7 to 8 times higher than the overall rate. In Toronto, where Black people are 4% of the population, they account for as many as 40% of the murder victims. And participation in crime, the limited evidence, mostly from a Toronto youth survey about 15 years ago, shows that Black young people are not notably more likely to be taking part in crimes. Black youth report more involvement than white youth in crimes such as robbery, fighting, or carrying a weapon, but less involvement in using various drugs or selling drugs. In most cases, the differences are fairly small. Contact with police. Very high numbers of Black youth, especially males, report being stopped regularly or searched by the police, approximately double the rate for white youth. Arrests. An analysis of 10,000 arrests in Toronto showed that Blacks were 50% more likely to be taken to a police station for processing after arrest and 100% more likely to be held overnight than were whites, even taking into account criminal history and age. When given bail, they had more conditions imposed. With regard to jail, there's a quote here, the extent to which Blacks and Aboriginals are overrepresented in Canadian correctional institutions is similar to that of African Americans in the United States. Blacks are overrepresented in federal prisons by more than 300% versus their population, while for Aboriginals, the overrepresentation is nearly 500,000%. The same disparities exist in provincial jails. In Nova Scotia, Blacks are 2% of the population, but 14% of the jail population. And in Manitoba, Indigenous are 16% of the population, but 70% of the jail population. In Alberta, the numbers for Indigenous are 6% and 39%. Moreover, these imbalances are getting worse, not better. And once in jail, these minorities are more likely to be subject to disciplinary procedures and less likely to be paroled. Indigenous people make up more than 21% of federal prisoners, but less than 14% of parolees and 50% underrepresentation. Public feelings regarding this. The perception of bias in the system is widespread, and not only among minorities. Available evidence indicates that a significant proportion of Canada's racial minority populations and a sizable proportion of the white population perceive bias in the criminal justice system. Sadly, none of these findings are new. Previous reports, such as the 1991 Manitoba Aboriginal Justice Inquiry and the 1994 Commission on Systemic Racism in the Ontario Criminal Justice System, as well as the 2005 Roots of Youth Violence in Ontario report, drew similar conclusions. Regular reports from the Federal Correction Investigator 2005 have also drawn attention to some of these issues. A great deal of improvement is still needed. Next, I wanted to touch on a recent book that has been written by an author named Tayari Jones, and her new novel explores the bonds of love in extreme circumstances against a larger background of race and mass incarceration. And there's an interview with audio from the author who joins Jeffrey Brown on PBS NewsHour to talk about her new novel, which is set in Atlanta and written in letter form, and the important questions that it raises about modern life and race and imprisonment are really important. And so, yeah, it's called An American Marriage, and the author's name is Tayari Jones. Next, I would like to shine a spotlight on the harrowing story of the Palestinian child prisoner Ahed Tamimi. 17-year-old Palestinian activist Ahed Tamimi has been called the Rosa Parks of Palestine. For years, she and her family have bravely stood up against the Israeli occupation, but now she faces up to 10 years in prison over an altercation with Israeli soldiers. Ahed's story has been making international headlines and attracting public support from prominent Black figures, including the likes of Danny Glover, Rosario Dawson, Jesse Williams, Michelle Alexander, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, Talib Kweli, Vic Mensa, and Ladybug Mecca, just to name a few. And recently, calls for the urgent release of the child prisoner, Ahed, by Amnesty International gained support from the well-known Jewish-American comedian Sarah Silverman, who on February 15th retweeted Amnesty's urgent call for her release and tweeted, "Jews have to stand up, even when the wrongdoing is by Jews or the Israeli government." On the 15th of December 2017, Ahed Tamimi and her family were protesting against Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. In a horrifying turn of events, Ahed's 14-year-old cousin, Mohammed, was shot in the head at close range by an Israeli soldier. He required intensive surgery where part of his skull was removed in order to dislodge the rubber bullet. Later that day, Ahed also came face-to-face with Israeli soldiers when they entered the yard of her family's house. A video, which has since gone viral, shows the unarmed teenage girl slapping, shoving, and kicking two armed Israeli soldiers who are wearing protective gear. It was clear that she posed no actual threat to them as they lightly swatted her advances away. But now she faces up to 10 years in prison, a punishment which is blatantly disproportionate. And to make matters worse, she will not be bailed. She must remain in custody until the end of her trial. Her trial ended, and she still remains in military detention and custody. And detaining her is outrageously excessive for such a comparatively small crime and entirely inappropriate for a child. And her detention cannot be justified. On the 19th of December, Ahed's home was raided by Israeli soldiers during the night. She was arrested, and the charges she faces are aggravated assault, obstructing the work of soldiers, and incitement. In detention, she endured aggressive interrogations, sometimes at night, and threats made against her family. Her trial before an Israeli military juvenile court happened, and she was sentenced to... Right now, indefinite detention. She's facing up to 10 years. So there's nothing Ahed Tamimi has done that can justify the continuing detention of her as a 17-year-old child. And she is one of approximately 350 Palestinian children that are held in Israeli prisons and detention centers. In an article published by Electronic Intifada from February 13th, 2018, titled "Ahed Tamimi Remains in Israeli Prison," as the trial adjourned, and it's written by Ali Abunema, the founder of EI. It highlights how, as this trial of Ahed Tamimi began, more than two dozen prominent U.S. Black artists and public figures started speaking out in support of Ahed, and how it talks about how she was brought before the Ofer military court in the occupied West Bank. And amid the presence of so many journalists and diplomats, the military judge ordered the session to be held behind closed doors, claiming this was for Ahed's own good. And in a tweet from EU and the Palestinians, which is the official Twitter account for the European Union delegation to the Palestinians, at 8:43 a.m. on February 13th, 2018, marked with the hashtag EU for human rights, it stated, "The EU rep and member states were today present at Ofer Military Court for the hearing of Ahed Tamimi. Ahead of the hearing, the judge ruled that the hearing should be held behind closed doors, thereby preventing diplomats from attending." And so this continuing repression of military detention has been highlighted through her case, as well as the plight of so many child prisoners, Palestinian child prisoners. And I just wanted to also reiterate how many public figures have been speaking out So in a statement that was published the week of her trial, around February 13th, prominent black figures have called on U.S. lawmakers to endorse a bill that would prohibit U.S. aid to Israel for being used for the military detention, torture, and abuse of Palestinian children. The bill was introduced by Betty McCollum in November, and the bill currently has 21 co-sponsors. So those backing the call include actors Rosario Dawson, Danny Glover, Grey Anatomy star Jesse Williams, the new Jim Crow Michelle Alexander, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Alice Walker, public intellectuals such as Angela Davis, Cornel West, Mark Lamont Hill, organizers Patrice Cullors and Dream Hampton, and rappers Tef Poe, Rick Mensa, and Jasiri X. Signatory Michael Bennett of the Seattle Seahawks was last year among several American football players who pulled out of a propaganda tour of Israel, explaining that he would not be used by Israel's government to whitewash the violations of Palestinian rights. And I just wanted to reiterate, Ahed is one of 350 Palestinian child prisoners. So while they all don't receive the same kind of international headlines and attention as she is, they're still suffering from the same type of oppression at the hands of the Israeli military detention system. And so some of the figures have come out and said, from Trayvon Martin to Mohammed Abu Qadir and Khalif Browder to Ahed Tamimi, racism, state violence, and mass incarceration have robbed our people of their childhoods and their futures, the public figures say, likening Israel's persecution of Ahed and other children to the state violence that has taken the lives and freedom of African-American youths. While our struggles may be unique, the parallels cannot be ignored, they add, noting that U.S. police, border patrol, and other law enforcement train with Israeli soldiers, police, and border agents utilizing similar repressive profiling tactics to target and harass our communities. In a striking example, Missouri Governor Eric Greitens announced last week that his state's National Guard would soon take part in joint training with the Israeli Army, which the Associated Press reported would involve homeland defense tactics and procedures. Amnesty International is reiterating its call on Israel to immediately free Ahed. And I just wanted to, the last thing I wanted to build on this story and reiterate and highlight is that this case of Ahed Tamimi has really raised the whole issue of administrative detention in Israeli military courts, and that Palestinian prisoners announced yesterday, there's breaking news, that they have now started a boycott of the campaign, a boycott campaign of Israeli military courts. So Ahed Tamimi's case and hundreds of other cases of Palestinian child prisoners and Palestinian prisoners being repressed by military trials and not afforded a fair trial as they should in what has often been touted by Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East has culminated in a unified move by Palestinian prisoners and accused to boycott Israeli military trials by not showing up for court appearances in protest of not being afforded a fair trial. They put out this statement. The statement on behalf of administrative detainees in Israeli jails, which was released on the 13th of February 2018. This Israeli Zionist colonial project continues to use the systemic policy of administrative detention, which is a violation of conditions and terms elaborated by international humanitarian law and international human rights law. Recently, the Israeli occupation forces intensified this use of this policy, as there are currently hundreds of Palestinians under administrative detention. This intensification happens regularly, not once or twice a year, but every few months. Palestinians have spent up to 14 years under administrative detention without charge or trial. Administrative detention is used as a weapon against Palestinians. It is one method of collective punishment against our people. International law puts strict conditions and rules on the use of administrative detention. The colonial occupation claims that its situation has met the emergency status and extreme conditions which allow administrative detention consistently for the past 50 years. The Israeli occupation authority does not only manipulate the language and implementation of international law, but it also claims administrative detention procedures are in keeping with international law. This is a lie. In reality, the Israeli military court and laws are in complete harmony with the occupation's policies against our people and represent a complete disregard for international norms. To this end, Israeli military courts, when it comes to administrative detention, adopts 99.9% of the suggestions coming from the Israeli intelligence department. Accordingly, as a continuation of our hunger strikes and our struggle against administrative detention, we administrative detainees in Israeli jails are announcing the beginning of a boycott campaign against military courts. We will begin an open boycott to all administrative detention courts because we believe that the core of resisting this policy comes from boycotting this Israeli legal system. As we go ahead with this collective step, we put our faith and trust in our people, their power and institutions, and in the civil society, which will not leave us alone in this fight. We also call on all human rights organizations, the Lawyers Union, the Palestinian Prisoner Club, and the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees to help us in this step and boycott all administrative detention courts with us. This is a national patriotic act that should not be violated by any individual or institution, so we call on the Palestinian Authority to make a submission to the International Criminal Court on the issue of administrative detention as soon as possible. Finally, we call on forming media, legal, and public committees to support us in this campaign. Glory is for our martyrs, and may we and our people get freedom, administrative detainees in the occupation prisons. So you can get all that information on the Electronic Intifada and on the John Howard Society website, as well as on the public broadcasting that was talking about the book by Tayari Jones.
Time now is 11:22 a.m. You are still listening to the Prison Radio Show on SKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and SKUT.ca. Up next is an interview with Josh Paven from the Prisoner Correspondence Project. Josh talked to us about the story behind the new Correctional Services Canada policy regarding the incarceration of trans prisoners in the federal system.
My name is Josh Paven. I am one of the collective members of the Prisoner Correspondence Project, a group based here in Montreal that is a support project for LGBTQ prisoners throughout Canada and the US.
So Correctional Services Canada, who runs the federal prisons in the country, recently passed a new policy that says that transgender prisoners are to be placed in men's or women's facilities based on how they self-identify. And I'm wondering if you could explain a bit more about this new policy. I'm sure that's not all there is to it. And talk a bit about how CSC is defining self-identify.
So I guess to start, CSC implemented this policy, but it was kind of done in spite of CSC. So there's a line that I really like from an American prison activist in the US named Jason Lydon, who when Chelsea Manning got out of prison last year, said, "We thank the movement, not the jailers, when our people get free." So with the very, very large caveat that none of these women are free, they're all still very much in prison. I think it's important that we recognize that it wasn't CSC who initiated this policy review and who initiated these changes in the policy. It was prisoners and prisoner advocates. And so we'll talk more about some of them a little bit later in the interview, but people like Jennifer Metcalf, people like Teresa Windsor, people like Salwan Obey. So the new policy, there are some very good things in it. But there's some very good things and some more debatable things in it. And so it's a very wide-ranging policy in terms of some of what it is allowing for. It supposedly is going to allow for placing an offender in a men's or women's institution according to their gender identity, rather than whatever is on their identification documents. It also is going to make the prison staff use preferred pronouns and preferred names. It is going to allow for more privacy in terms of showering and urinalysis. It sets out specifications for individualized protocols for searches and the gender of the guards who are going to do searches. It allows the purchase of what are considered gendered items for prisoners in those prisons.
Since you started talking about this before talking about what the policy was, can you tell us the story of how this came about?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2016, let me make sure I have my years right. Yeah, so in 2016, the Correctional Services of Canada did a sort of comprehensive review of what their policies around gender dysphoria and trans prisoners should be. And they came up, and this was spearheaded by a few things. Jennifer Metcalf, who I mentioned, who's the executive director of the West Coast Prison Justice Legal Society, had filed several human rights complaints on behalf of trans prisoners, specifically around the gender of the prison that they were housed in, but with some other issues as well. The new Correctional Investigator of Canada, Ivan Zinger, had talked about trans health in the report of the Correctional Investigator for the first time ever in the report that came out in 2016. And so part of the cumulative effects of these things were, so because of these, CSC was doing a comprehensive review of what their policies related to trans prisoners were. They came out with a new policy last winter. So this is now January 2017. And the policy made some changes in terms of the requirements for prisoners to receive sexual reassignment surgery. However, having that surgery as a prerequisite for transferring prisons remained in place. So a few days after that new policy was announced, there was a town hall in Kingston, Ontario, where a local trans activist there named Teresa Windsor asked a question to the Prime Minister in a very publicized town hall saying, the CSC just reviewed this policy, they're saying this, I believe that holding trans women in men's prisons is a form of torture. Why are you continuing to torture these women? And the Prime Minister said he didn't know anything about this. Thank you for bringing it to his attention. He was going to be looking into it. And so it was a bit of a slap in the face for CSC, given that they just announced their new policy. I didn't even think it was a week ahead of time. I think it was just a few days before this very public challenging of it. And so when the media got back in touch with CSC saying, what's happening? Are you reviewing this policy? The Prime Minister is saying he doesn't agree with the one that you've just announced. What's going on? Correctional Services of Canada said, oh, actually the policy is back under review. And while it's under review, we're going to be evaluating these cases on a case-by-case basis. So that was last January. Fast forward to June, I believe it was, when for the first time under the case-by-case policy, a trans woman was permitted to transfer to a women's facility without having sexual reassignment surgery. Her name was Fallon Obing. And then fast forward to December, when CSC implemented this new policy that they rolled out in a sort of public relations fanfare just last week.
What's the Prisoner Correspondence Project's take on the new policy? Like, what do you guys think of the policy that finally got implemented more recently?
So of the things that have happened in the last year, the part that I didn't mention is that we'd also launched a campaign. We talked to some of our in Canada who were living these conditions and also who are members in the US who were living under different but similar policies. And we had come up with a sort of platform of, I believe it was 10 points that we wanted to see in the new policy. And so some of them are in the new policy, some of them are not. Some of them are vaguely in the new policy. So I guess in terms of maybe in terms of some of the key ones, one of the things that we're happy to see in the policy is that the gender of the prison that someone's going to be incarcerated in, it's not an automatic transfer, you know? So one of the things that we heard from our members was that it was important that it be their choice as to whether they wanted to move to a women's prison or not. As you may know, there are a lot fewer women's prisons in Canada, and so being transferred to a women's prison also may mean that you're transferred much, much further away from your family and your friends and the kinds of outside networks of support that you have. Also, people have those networks of support in prison as well, right? And so having to start over all over again in a prison that, just because it's a women's prison, doesn't necessarily mean it will be friendly and welcoming and all of these other things, and having to sort of start over there alone, away from the networks that you've already developed in the prison that you were in, wouldn't necessarily be everyone's choice. And so it was important for us that the choice to move be the choice of the prisoner and not of the prison administration. And so that's one thing that we're happy to see. In terms of, for several of the changes that are being made, you see this language of, unless there are overriding health or safety concerns which cannot be resolved. And so to what extent that happens, we're going to have to see how the policy plays out. When we've been putting forward these proposals, we were envisaging them and talking about them in terms of rights, right, rather than in terms of things to be taken into consideration, because there obviously are a lot of loopholes that prison administrations could still use to prevent giving all kinds of these things to trans prisoners. And then there's a few things that didn't appear in the policy that we did want to see. And so trying to think, I guess, about trans prisoners' rights as trying to think about it a bit more holistically. So also talking about prioritizing alternatives to incarceration and not just thinking about trans prisoners once they're already in prison. Or not just thinking about trans people and their relationship to prisons from once they're already in prison. I think a couple of the other thing, and then also to think about the fact that many of the issues that trans prisoners face are the same issues that all prisoners face, right? And so things, even if it might be a bit more pronounced or a bit more intensified when it comes to how trans prisoners live these same circumstances. So things like access for outside groups and visitors. You know, one of the 9 points that we were calling for was to make it easier for people to be able to get into federal prisons and to be able to access friends and family and community members in prison. That's obviously something that wasn't in this policy. Another thing that we called for was to raise the wages and living allowances of prisoners. It's great that people can now order things from both the men's and women's catalogs, but if you don't have the money to be able to order those things, it's not actually giving you anything, mm-hmm. right? So as it currently stands, the maximum pay for jobs in prisons is $6.90 a day. The basic living allowances, if you're not able to work, and there's a much higher chance that trans prisoners might not be able to work because they may be in protective custody, then the basic living allowances is $1 to $2.50 a day.
And with the ruling that just came out that squashed the lawsuit that prisoners were bringing about the mm-hmm. pay cuts, you know, those wages are going to stay really low.
Exactly.
Yeah. In an article that ran in the Globe and Mail on January 31st, there were two comments from different people that I'm curious to hear your take on. So people have a lot of different critiques of this policy. One of the critiques that was coming out in that article was there's no plan for how to implement training for staff. So even though they're asking for, you know, certain kind of individualized protocols, that's great, but there's no training in place for staff in terms of, like, teaching people how to use preferred pronouns or, like, teaching people how to do these individualized protocols in ways that are respectful. So someone named Helen Kennedy from Egal Canada was citing that as one of the things that were missing. And then someone named Jeremy Diaz of the Canadian Centre for Gender and Sexual Diversity brought up this idea of trans and non-binary specific correctional facilities, which I noticed is not on the list of things that you guys were asking for. I'm wondering if you can talk about, like, either or both of those as, like, critiques of the policy, like specifically, like, staff training and what kind of role that could play, and then also this idea that comes up over and over again in terms of, like, specific facilities and getting into the whole, like, building new prisons kind of way of going about this.
So I think in terms of staff training, the kind of rhetoric that you're seeing in the policy was that training will be made available, but obviously making something available and making people do it are two very different things. Mm-hmm. I think in general, I mean, our group understands itself as a prison abolitionist group, and there's sort of a general consensus amongst a lot of prison abolitionist organizers that the kinds of reforms that we need to be pushing for in prisons are ones that are not about directing more resources and more money and more efforts towards constructing new prisons. And so I think that this idea being put forward by Jeremy Diaz that we need to be having trans and non-binary prisons is, well, I think maybe coming from a good place, not the strategic route that activists invested in supporting LGBTQ prisoners should be putting their time.
Now that this policy has been passed, I think there have also been, like, different provincial versions of this policy coming about too. Do you have any sense of, like, where things are headed in terms of the situation for trans prisoners in Canada in the future?
There have been policies that have come out in, I forget the exact dates, but over the last maybe 3 years, it hasn't been a very long time, in both BC and Ontario. I know we recently did a small research project with the CURE, the Community University Research Exchange, looking at what some of the policies were, or what some of the understandings of the policies were in some of the provincial systems where they don't have a stated outline policy. And several of them said that they sort of informally follow the CSC guidelines. And so I think that is, so the effect is not just at the federal level, but also on the provincial level as well.
What kind of things does the Prisoner Correspondence Project have in the works for the upcoming year?
I mean, I think we, while this has been a win in some ways, as I was talking about, there's still like many things that we wanted to see changed that weren't changed with this policy. And so really pursuing some of those, both still within CSC and also some of the other prison systems that we work within. Because while many of our Canadian members are in the federal system in Canada, we've got members all over Canada and the US. Mm-hmm. And still many people are agitating in many of those jurisdictions.
That was Josh Pavin from the Prisoner Correspondence Project here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. And you want to stay tuned because next on the program, we're going to hear an excerpt from an interview produced by CFRC Radio in Kingston. It's an interview with Jared Shook, who is a former prisoner, and he's discussing the four-year resistance to pay cuts in prison, specifically at Collins Bay Institution. And he also speaks about the struggles for better treatment for prisoner workers in general. So stay tuned here to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT.
We invite you to envision the future with us. Welcome to Black Future 3. A night of Afrocentric artistic expression, a group of melanin-gifted artists will take over the stage and invite you into their universe. Come and get to know the revolutionary band from Buffalo. We stole the show, the luminous artist, Big Sissy, the eclectic rapper Simon Says and the dreamy songstress, Cyber, on February 24th, at Bar La Ritz, 179 John Talon West. Come celebrate your Black History Month with them, because the future is also history. Come design it with us. This is a CKUT Go presentation.
We bring you an important interview on an issue we know is close to a lot of the prisoners in this area, prison wages. In 2013, the Conservative government introduced a 30% pay cut to wages for work done by prisoners, called it a food and accommodation tax, and eliminated bonus pay for work done at Corcan facilities. Corcan is a crown corporation that contracts out prison labor to both the public and private sector and operates several factories in the Kingston area. Prisoners are forced to purchase items such as stamps and personal hygiene products through government-designated suppliers, and wages had already decreased sevenfold in actual purchasing power, as they had not increased since first being established in the early 1980s. After exhausting internal grievance procedures, prisoners here in Kingston at Collins Bay Institution launched a work strike, which spread to federal prisons across Canada. Since 2014, several prisoners were fighting a lawsuit against the Government of Canada, challenging the constitutionality of the pay cuts. At the end of January 2018, a federal court in Ottawa threw out the case, ruling that prison labor falls under programming and that prisoners are not in an employer-employee relationship with the Correctional Service of Canada. I spoke with Jared Shook by phone. He is an expert, a regular contributor when he was inside at Collins Bay here in Kingston. He was a spokesperson for the work strike back in 2013. He was an applicant to the lawsuit in question, and he's now studying criminology at the University of Ottawa, where he continues to be active in prison-related issues. We discussed the history of the inmate pay system, resistance to prison pay cuts inside, the four-year lawsuit process, and the next steps in the struggle for better wages and dignity for prisoner workers. Jared Shook, welcome to the show. Glad to have you back. You've always been a big contributor to CFRC Prison Radio, and we're happy to have you back on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure, as always, to reconnect with you, particularly from the other side of the fence.
Why don't we begin with some history behind this so-called inmate pay system? So would you be able to give our listeners an overview of what exactly the inmate pay system is and where it comes from in correctional history?
Essentially, the rate of pay for prisoners who perform work in institutions that contributes to the operation and maintenance of the prison, as well as productive labor that occurs at Corcan Industries, was compensated officially, as far as I understand, in the 80s, based on a portion of the federal minimum wage at the time. The way that they had calculated it was that a typical Canadian would need to spend a certain percentage of their earnings on food, clothing, accommodation, basic necessities. So they basically did some calculations and figured out that based on that assessment, prisoners would be entitled to, or it would be fair to give prisoners approximately $6.90 a day or so. Actually, I think it was upwards of $7 a day at that time. Through the course of time, they made a few revisions to it. Ultimately, they ended up with a pay scale that ran from the lower end of $5 on way up to $6.90 a day. And your rate of pay was either A-level, B-level, C-level, or D-level. I think there was also an E-level that would be a refusal to work that would entitle you to, I believe, $1 a day. And the rate that you would be paid for the work that you do in the institution would be also sort of tied to your correctional plan and how well you do the job, and sort of as an incentive, or they would use it as an incentive to encourage people to work and do programs. Since the 80s, obviously in all economies in Canada and around the world, inflation has occurred. So the purchasing power for prisoners in the 80s versus the purchasing power for prisoners in 2017 has changed. To use the words of the correctional investigator, $8.16, essentially, as far as purchasing power goes, is about equivalent to $60 or so in 2017 in terms of how much purchasing power you would have that with that money. So throughout the course of time, or throughout the passage of time, wages have not increased for prisoners for work that they perform in institutions. And it's a lot more costly for them to buy the things that they need, hygiene items, making telephone calls to loved ones, stamps, other necessities, clothing items, things of that nature.
So just to be clear, you're saying that the costs of the same items that you'd be buying in the 80s have jumped about sevenfold, and the wages have remained the same.
I mean, so the way the correctional investigator termed it, he said like a typical what he would call a typical canteen basket. So if you think about like what would be the basic items that a prisoner would buy every 2 weeks when they have the opportunity to go to canteen, we're talking, like I said, hygiene items, maybe a couple cans of tuna, you know, maybe some stamps, maybe some stationery, things of that nature. You know, in the 80s, $8 would provide all of those things, right? And now the same items would cost you about $60, right? So that's sort of where that comes from. But as we got towards 2013, in 2012, actually, most of the listeners might be aware that we had a conservative government at that time who had arrived with a majority government on their third term. And essentially they were elected, I would argue, as a result of their tough on crime agenda, or at least they played that very well politically. And as a part of that agenda, one of the things that was a centerpiece was this idea of what Vic Tay's described as inmate accountability. And he said that one of the ways that prisoners needed to be accountable was by paying more for their stay in prison. So they introduced a food and accommodation tax of 30% on the wages that prisoners were earning, which were already, I would argue, paltry. And they also eliminated the $2.20 per hour incentive payments that prisoners received for the productive labor that they did at Corcan.
Can you explain what Corcan is and what kind of work the prisoners perform within the framework of Corcan?
Yeah. So Corcan is essentially a Crown special operating agency. Prisoners who work at Corcan engage in often productive labor that has included in the past, to my knowledge and experience, contracts with IKEA, assembling couches, doing textiles, sewing, refurbishing buses for the city of Ottawa, manufacturing furniture that you can find in many university libraries and government offices. They also have welding programs there. And, you know, to be fair, it's not entirely centered around productive labor with profit-seeking. I mean, there are also some elements, certainly, that are geared towards training, such as their welding program. And, you know, I do know of some individuals who have received welding tickets that have served them well on the outside. So, I mean, it has a couple of components. Part of it is training, but also productive labor. Interestingly, however, and folks who are listening to this can refer to a National Post article that was published a few months back. Corcan's ability to actually make a profit based on the way it operates has been pretty limited over the years, and essentially it often costs more for them to run the program than they actually make in terms of profits.
But I would presumably, for a company like IKEA to contract Corcan, they must be making some kind of,
of
profit out of that.
Yeah, so if anybody's profiting, it would be the companies who are contracting cheap labor from prisoners, right?
Like a majority of the work done in Corcan facilities, it seems to be a blend of contracts, like cost-saving contracts for the government and some private sector partners that they contract with. Is that right?
Yeah, that's that would be exactly how I would explain.
And then there's also institutional jobs that fall under this pay system. So these, what kinds of things would prisoners do?
So, I mean, we can speak about this a little later in the conversation, but, you know, one of the things that CSC is arguing, the government's lawyers are arguing, is that there's no employer-employee relationship between the Correctional Service of Canada and prisoners when they perform labor in institutions. The reason being is that these aren't jobs, these are essentially programs. And, I mean, pushing a broom and cleaning floors and cleaning bathrooms, doing plumbing, doing electrical work, grounds work, mowing lawns, shoveling snow, up to and including administrative work in offices, which assist with managers of different departments of the institution, committee work as individuals on prisoner committees do. These are all jobs that happen in the institution. Some people even have jobs as caretakers for other prisoners who might have mobility issues or otherwise in the school as tutors. I mean, so arguably there is a skill set to be acquired in doing some of these jobs, some perhaps more than others. But at the end of the day, it's work, right? And since it's work, arguably, it would fall within the boundaries of the employee-employer relationship, which we attempted to argue unsuccessfully.
You wrote a really good piece, I remember, in 2013 called Incentive to Scrutinize, an Account of Accountability, that sort of went through all the ways in which you exhausted the channels, right? Internal channels to try to challenge this announced pay cut.
Within the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, the Correctional Service of Canada is responsible to consult with prisoners on all issues other than security-related matters, so they can have input into the decision-making. We could get into that later in our conversation about whether that's a legitimate process, but they did announce that they were going to do this, and they did ask the population for their input. So prisoners in the prison where I was serving time, as well as all across Canada, certainly made submissions outlining the potential negative impacts of this decision. To our knowledge, none of that information was taken into consideration, and in October 2013, the decision was implemented. So, at the institution I was serving time at in Collins Bay, prisoners actually decided to engage in a work strike, a refusal to work, as a way of drawing attention to their grievances. And very shortly after, I think also with the assistance of some coverage from the CBC, it spread across Canada in every region of the country. And that strike lasted approximately 3 weeks. I can't say how it unfolded in every institution, but in the institution where I was serving time, folks were looking for ways that they could get to the table and have a conversation about the policy and see if the key decision makers would at least address some of their concerns. And obviously, the goal was to reverse the decision, but ultimately, people wanted to have a conversation and have their grievances heard.
So, can you talk a bit about how that work strike happened? Like, how did people actually get together and decide to stop work, and what kind of work stopped, and what effect did that have in the institutions?
I mean, I can't really identify a top-down sort of organizational strategy that I saw unfold in the institution. Right? There seemed like there's just a collective will to address the policy, and it's sort of spontaneous. Well, spontaneous as spontaneous can be when the government announces a decision like they announced, to do what instinctively I think most folks would do, whether in the community or in a prison, which is use one of the few powers that they have left, which is their right to refuse, right? And so I think it was simply a collective will of the population at that time. I think the unfortunate thing is on the leadership side of things, in terms of, you know, what you might see in the community with like a labor union who might have, you know, several folks who are spokespeople for their group and sort of strategize and lead, is that unfolds a little bit differently in a prison context than it does in the community. Not because, you know, there aren't the same coercive sort of consequences for engaging in such a thing, but the institution, the correctional authorities, have done a fairly good job over the years, I would argue, of dividing the population. And I'm talking even within the institution itself, and disrupting the ability of prisoners to collectively assemble, stand together in solidarity with one another. And some of those reasons, I mean, I could outline now, for instance, Collins Bay Institution, right? So it's a medium security, well, now it's a max, medium, and a minimum. But even if we just look at the medium setting itself, right, it's actually situated in a way that you've got people who are all classified in that same medium frame. They all have very different conditions of confinement, and they all might have different things at stake. So, for instance, you know, at that time, 4-Block was open, and 4-Block was known to be the sort of more old school, maybe guys there with what would be perceived to be less to lose, and maybe more willingness to participate in something like that. And then you've got what at the time would have been 6, 7, and 8-Block, which were more like we would call that the medium of the medium, who may be closer to moving towards something else, maybe have a few more, we'll say, carrots dangling. The sticks chasing them might also matter, but maybe not quite as much. And then you've got nine block, which is the sort of lowest responsibility-based living unit in the institution, where people are essentially planning on going from there to parole or to lower security institution. So in terms of having a sort of cohesive group of people who collectively are in the same position and have the same stakes, it's just a very difficult thing to manage. And so as far as maintaining solidarity towards the work strike, it was just a difficult thing to manage. And
that was Jared Shook. He was interviewed by our friends at CFRC Radio in Kingston. You can listen to the entire interview from their website. Jared Shook was talking about the food and accommodation tax that was passed by the Harper government and the resistance by prisoners to their wages. They fought a lawsuit. Jared Shook talked about the work strike, but the lawsuit, unfortunately, at the end of January of this year, a federal court in Ottawa threw out the case ruling that prison labor falls under programming and not under an employer-employee relationship. We'll likely hear more from Jared Shook in future episodes of the Prison Radio Show.
The time is presently 11:56, and you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. We're on the air and on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m.
The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, March 8th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, you can contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate, and folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. So thank you so much for tuning in to this week's edition of the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Candace.
And my name is Yasmin.
And we've been your hosts for today's show. Stay tuned for Butcher T's Noontime Cuts here on CKUT.
Thank you. Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means.
Do you?
It comes from the Latin root habilis,